Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelzang. We have an important, timely show today, and our guest is Kevin Prindeville. Kevin Prindeville is Justice in Aging's Executive Director. Kevin is a nationally recognized expert on Medicare and Medicaid policy and has served as counsel in several class action lawsuits protecting low-income seniors' access to public benefits, and Kevin has represented low-income individuals having trouble obtaining health care.
And also a place where we have the most opportunity and potential to reform our healthcare system into something that we all would hope and wish it would be, something that was person-centered and really responsive to what people most need, not just to be not sick, but to be really living a full life.
That, of course, is our guest today, Kevin Prindeville, who joins us to discuss his organization, Justice in Aging, and the important work they're doing on behalf of senior citizens in America. So please join me in welcoming via Skype to the Not Old Better Show, Kevin Prindeville. Well, Kevin Prindeville, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, good to talk to you, too. I think the timing is really good. I know you're a lawyer by training, but you're also the leader of a very interesting organization, Justice in Aging. For my listeners who may not be aware of Justice in Aging, tell us briefly what it is that you do.
Yeah, so we are a national nonprofit that uses the power of law to fight senior poverty. A lot of people don't fully understand just how many older adults in our communities across the country are struggling and living in poverty. And so we are a group of lawyers that use our legal training and skills to try to address that problem by really trying to better understand the laws and policies around the programs that are designed to support older adults. And then by working with local members in the community to identify problems with those policies and those programs, and then using those legal tools to try to fix them. So whether it's lobbying in the courts of Congress or state capitals, or bringing class action lawsuits to fix problems, we use those legal tools to make programs better.
Kevin, you write a lot about the subject of senior poverty, and we're talking on kind of the middle of December, maybe on the verge of President Trump's tax plan. And there are going to be some changes potentially, although we don't know for sure what the changes might be to the Affordable Health Care Act. But that could impact potentially millions of Americans, especially senior citizens who are living in poverty conditions. What do you kind of think is the potential impact of some of the changes that might be coming from the tax plan?
Yeah, well, the potential impact of the tax plan on older adults is quite significant and quite negative, and especially upon middle-class and lower-income older adults and middle-class and lower-income older adults of the future. You know, I think as a baseline, it's important for people to understand just what the current state of senior poverty looks like. According to the most recent census data, about 7.1 million older adults live in poverty across the country. That's about 15% per the supplemental poverty measure that the U.S. Census Bureau releases. So it's a large number of people, and it's actually growing. Older adults were the only age population to see an increase in poverty over the last year. So it's growing because the numbers of seniors are growing, and because of several changes in our economy that we've seen take place over the last several decades. We've seen wages stagnate. We've seen it become more difficult for people to save for retirement. There's less opportunity to use a traditional pension to help generate those savings. Our social safety net programs really haven't kept up with the pace of growth around costs like healthcare and college and housing. So we've seen several economic factors that are happening that have led to this growing number of seniors that are living in poverty. And this tax bill is only going to accentuate all of those problems. You know, it's a tax bill that overwhelmingly provides benefits to the most wealthy and to corporations and provides very little benefit to middle class and lower income folks. So nothing about the tax bill is going to make it easier for middle-aged people to save for older age. Nothing in the bill helps people that are already older and living in poverty, by increasing their benefits or allowing to keep more of their income. There's really very little benefit of this bill that actually flows out to those middle-class and lower-income folks. So So mostly it is driving more wealth to wealthier people and really exacerbating what we're seeing over the last several decades, this growing inequality between a small group of Americans who have very, very, very much wealth and then the rest of Americans that are left with much less. And then, of course, the most poor that are living really in extreme extreme poverty. So the tax bill does nothing to help the problem and, in fact, actually makes the problem worse. What one of the things that worries us most about this tax proposal is that it increases the federal deficit. So the bill, in addition to essentially transferring money from the middle class to the most wealthy, also increases the federal deficit by at least $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. And that in itself is not, you know, we don't think that that's necessarily a negative thing, but we do know that that increase in the deficit is going to be used by some of the very same lawmakers that are pushing the tax bill to turn around and say, because of the growing deficit, we now have to cut the programs that older adults rely on as they age, programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program or food stamps, that this growing deficit is going to be used as an excuse to now cut programs. And that will be tragic, just totally tragic for the low-income older adults in our communities that rely on those programs just to meet basic needs, pay rents, keep the heat on, keep food on the table, and get access to health care. So we're in a really crucial time in which this tax bill could just be the first of many dominoes to fall that would greatly weaken the economic security of seniors across the country.
And further, when it comes to poverty policy, even though there are gaps and holes in this this tax plan, when you think about poverty policy, there are just misperceptions about it, because education and jobs, those kinds of things, don't help someone, often female, in their 70s and 80s who are struggling to cover food and housing. So what do we do as an audience that are listening here and as a society to kind of fight this? I know you've written about it extensively. You have a five-step plan. You want to talk a little bit about that, Kevin?
Yeah, well, the first thing is exactly like you said, Paul, recognizing that poverty for low-income, for older adults, looks different than poverty for other populations. So for children and for working-age individuals, we pursue certain policies like improving education systems and improving job training programs, and those are great and really important for those populations. But for older adults, those don't really provide an answer. An older woman who's in her 80s or mid-80s isn't going to benefit from, a job training program or education in the same way. So we need a different set of solutions that really reflect the reality of these older adults living in poverty. And so they must... We must start by just really strengthening the programs that people rely on today. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, we need to make those programs strong and even more robust than they are now, and certainly not think about cutting any of those programs. As we do that, as we think about how we provide care for those that are already old and living in poverty, we also need to recognize the systemic structures and policies that lead to that. So if you look at poverty among older adults, it particularly impacts women and people of color, groups that we know suffered from discrimination and lack of employment opportunities, lack of education opportunities when they were younger. So we need to be looking at how we can change that for generations that are just now working age or younger, so that they don't face the same type of economic insecurity when they're older adults. So we need to look at things like the pay gap, that women are paid less to do the same work than men. That leads to economic insecurity when folks are older. We need to look at issues like caregiving. We have millions of Americans every year taking time out of their job to care for children or for older adults in their lives. That leads to loss of economic opportunity for them. So we need to address that through policies that look at paid caregiving opportunities and opportunities for people to receive support to do that important work at home and not suffer a consequence in their economic security as they grow older. So we need to be looking at this combination of both how we really support older adults that are currently now struggling to make ends meet, as well as look at how we can improve policies for folks while they're working age so that they can be even better prepared as they grow older. And really recognizing that it's not really individual decisions that people are making. It's really these systemic structures that make it very difficult for people to make enough money so that they can save, so that they can be prepared. We really haven't created an environment where individuals can prepare themselves. We've really been holding people back in our policies.
And Justice in Aging as an organization is deep in the trenches of this fight. You mentioned that your lawyers and you're using legislation and policy to fight this, but you actually have clients that you see too. So you're really getting to know these people firsthand.
We do. You know, a lot of the work that we do is at a systemic level. We are a national organization, so we're supporting advocates in every state across the country, and then also very active in Washington, D.C. So a lot of our work is through training and assistance we provide to professionals that serve older adults. But when we bring big cases, big class action lawsuits, we have individual clients, and we get to know very well their individual stories. And they're incredible and powerful and oftentimes quite sad, but also very beautiful. You know, we meet a lot of seniors who really are getting by with very little, you know, just saving up to buy a tea kettle so that they can have warm tea, or saving up to buy a new blanket and living in a, you know, small apartment, you know, growing herbs in their windowsill so that they can save money. And not have to buy something like that at a grocery store. You know, but these are folks that have very rich lives, you know, even as they struggle financially to make ends meet, very rich lives, spending time with friends and family and really seeking and desiring to be connected to community, really wanting to continue to give back to their communities, whether it's through, you know, a local senior center where they advocate with other seniors for improvements to a local transportation system, or spending time at a community center where they mentor and work with younger kids. So, you know, even as we see our seniors really, really struggle with these decisions that no one should have to struggle with in America about whether, you know, to cut a pill in half so that they, you know, can spread the medication out to make sure that they can afford to buy that last bag of groceries for the month. You know, these tough decisions, but I don't want anyone to think that that means that these folks aren't also very happy and joyful and proud and loving people that are very much connected to their community. So so it's a difficult thing for us to see as we see these folks struggle, but it's also a beautiful thing to see people that are so strong and resilient and so committed to giving back to and being part of the fabric of their community.
Thank you for sharing that. I think it's so important to focus on the people and to see how some of these policies are actually impacting them. It's easy to stand back. It's easy to, even at times, I know Justice in Aging isn't doing this, but it's easy to stand almost behind some of the policy. And there's probably no more complex policy than healthcare. So I want to shift gears for just a second and talk about an area of your own personal expertise, and that's the complex area of healthcare. And in particular, I want to focus on this subject of dual eligibility. And without maybe getting too down in the weeds, tell us a little bit about this issue of the dual eligible and the cost shifting that goes on between Medicare and Medicaid, because Medicare and Medicaid can work together. This is a large population of people. CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, tells us that there are over 9 million people that fall into this category. That's about 14% of the Medicaid enrollment. So in terms of what Justice in Aging is doing, what is it that you're bringing to the table to address some of these issues of dual eligibility? Because it's very a complex one.
Yeah, it really is. And dual eligibles in many ways are really where the heart of our healthcare system, they're really at the heart of our healthcare system. They are folks with some of the greatest needs, and also a place where we have the most opportunity and potential to reform our healthcare system into something that we all would hope and wish it would be, something that was person-centered and really responsive to what people most need, not just to be not sick, but to be really living a full life in on their terms. So there's real opportunity and potential that we can achieve in our system by focusing on these dual eligibles. As you said, a dual eligible is someone who receives Medicare because they qualify for Medicare, so they're either 65 and over or have a disability. But they also qualify for Medicaid, which means that they must meet certain income and asset thresholds. So they're low-income folks that are eligible for Medicare. They are people that often have multiple chronic conditions, that have a long-term care need, that are taking multiple prescription drugs. They might deal with serious mental illness or be facing other social problems like homelessness or addiction. Those are all folks that are likely to be dually eligible. So it is a group that has a high need, that we do currently spend a lot of Medicare and Medicaid dollars on serving that need. And so anything we can do to improve the way that Medicare and Medicaid serve the population will greatly benefit those folks, as well as help generally transform our healthcare system. Right now and traditionally, the Medicare and Medicaid programs haven't always had a good way of communicating with each other. So people that are on both the programs, instead of kind of getting twice the benefit and power of those programs, they often end up with something less than that, because there isn't smooth transitions and great communication and aligned incentives between the two programs, and therefore incentivized to provide different things instead of really just focused on the person. So we've been very actively working with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and with states and advocates across the country to get these two systems working better together, an effort that started about 5 or 6 years ago. And many states have taken on these really innovative pilot projects where they're creating new kinds of health plans that integrate both the benefits of Medicare and Medicaid. They integrate the financing of those two programs, and really trying to create rules where, instead of the focus being on whether this person is Medicare eligible or Medicaid eligible or eligible for both, just really looking at what does this person need and what does this person want, and trying to really center the care, the doctors, the long-term care providers, the pharmacists, the behavioral health, around, you know, what does this person need? Not what does this doctor need or what does this hospital need, but really what does the person need? Trying to really shift that frame of reference. And there's been some success. Certainly there's been some smoothing of the way the programs speak together. There's been some increased delivery of innovative benefits to people in some of these states. Still a lot of work to do, but I think some real promise in breaking down some of these silos and really putting the person at the center of their care.
I imagine it is a lot of work, because often these dual eligibles are in poor health and maybe they require more care compared with other Medicare or Medicaid beneficiaries.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the clients of ours that are folks that, you know, need a lot of care, a lot of long-term care, people that have a long-term care need that can only be met by receiving a lot of support in the home, having a personal care attendant come into their home several days a week to help them with things like the activities of daily living, we call them, things like bathing or feeding or, medication management, things that are really essential. So these might be people that have ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, or folks that have a disability that requires them to use a wheelchair, or folks that are on a ventilator, people with very, very high levels of needs, also individuals with dementia. And it's only by really supporting them at home and in the community with personal care attendants, or getting them to an adult day healthcare program every day. It's only through those types of really intense supports that we're able to keep them out of the hospital, keep them out of a more expensive nursing facility that would separate them from their family and community. So these are folks with great need, and again, great potential and opportunity if we can use the Medicaid and Medicare resources that we have to really support them and to support their desires and intentions for how they want to live their life.
In addition to healthcare, Kevin, I know you are skilled in communications. We've talked a little bit about legislation and policy leadership, in addition to the advocacy that goes on within justice and aging, and of course, expertise in the law. What does it take to lead the organization, Justice and Aging. I'd like to know what Justice and Aging is going to focus on in 2018.
You know, as any effective leader will tell you, the most important thing for me is that I've got a wonderful team of people that I work with here, and folks that just really are so deeply committed to the cause, to fighting senior poverty, and really putting the needs of our clients and the people that we're here to serve front and center in everything that we do, and take great pride and responsibility in doing that. So it's wonderful to have a great team of people. It's difficult right now to operate in this environment, to try to create positive social change in an environment where there's so much going on. Every day, every minute brings new news in some policy arena, new news in some political arena, and that's a difficult thing both to stay on top of and then also to find focus within. So certainly as a leader of an organization that's trying to make positive change, a lot of my time is spent on helping us as an organization and then our partners and then the policymakers that we're trying to influence really focus and not lose sight of the big pressing issues of the day. So in 2018, we see those big pressing issues as, you know, continuing to be for us, you know, shining a light on senior poverty and the growing numbers. That one of the things that's been keeping me up at night these last few months is the growing number of homeless older adults. I live in the Bay Area and in Oakland, California, and we're seeing a tremendous increase in homelessness generally and a tremendous increase in the older population that's homeless. Every overpass that I walk through on my way to work or that I drive by while taking my kids to school is filled with tents and encampments of folks. And when I've spent time walking through those tented areas, they're filled with older people. And as we've been working with some researchers here to better understand that, it's older people who are becoming homeless for the first time as older people. They live their whole working life housed and middle class, working two jobs, but then they suffer an injury or they lose a spouse or they go through a divorce and they can no longer work or no longer have enough income to support the rent, and very distressing. And it's one of those problems that people are so inundated with information about so many things that it's some of those stories about homeless older adults that just go unattended to and don't make it onto people's radar. So, you know, in 2018, we're really focused on continuing to put issues like homelessness among older adults on people's radar. We're really focused on continuing to fight to protect the core programs that help older adults meet their basic needs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Those are all areas that we think are going to continue to be right in front and center in Washington, D.C. We think Republicans are going to be advancing proposals to cut those programs. And so we're going to be there to explain the negative impact that any cuts in those programs would have on older adults. And then in the midst of all that, Paul, we're going to try to continue to make positive change, too, you know, try to increase at a local level what counties and cities are doing to respond to homelessness. We're working with coalitions across the country to try to increase access to oral health for older adults, which we know is an unmet need. Just trying to continue to make positive change, even while we also try to protect and defend what exists now, so that we don't take a step back as a country in how we care for older adults. You know, that those folks in our population that we think are entitled to great respect and dignity in how they live their lives and how they grow older.
Well, Justice in Aging is the name of the organization. We've been talking to Kevin Prindeville. For my audience, these are all very important issues, Kevin. And you can go to justiceinaging.org. You can find out more there about any one of these subjects, but there are webinars and training. If anyone's interested in making a year-end donation, we'll put links up to do just that on the website. But Kevin Prindeville, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul. It's really a pleasure to be with you again, and have a wonderful holiday season.
You too, and please keep up the good work, and we're going to share this widely.
Great. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Kevin. My thanks to our guest today, Kevin Prindeville, whose work at Justice in Aging is important and timely. Please check out justiceinaging.org to find out more. As usual, we'll post links to everything, even where you can make a donation to Justice in Aging, which is an important one. I thank you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me today. I'm always interested in feedback, and you can leave it at iTunes, Google Play, or send me email at info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better. The Not Old Better Show. Thanks to all. Happy holidays. And remember, offer some kindness, service, and love to everyone you meet. You'll never regret it, and you'll make a difference. Thanks, everybody.